This is a Pinball News production.
All right, so Michael Scheiss, the guy that runs this gig, asked me, he said he was big on the history this year, the history of this, the history of that. And the one thing that he said that they really hadn't seen a lot of is the history of EM arcade games. So he asked me to do something because he knows I'm into not just pinball, I'm into EM arcade stuff. So, just more goofy questions. How many people out there own any EM arcade games? Okay, well, a fair number. Okay, how many own more than 9 EM arcade games? Okay, anybody with greater than 50? Okay, just curious. All right, you're all kind of normal humans, maybe. Well, anyways, I kind of got into them, and I did a website on them because there really wasn't a lot of, at least when I started, there wasn't a lot of information on them. There was only this one book, this Larry Biza book, this kind of pink book that Larry had that had basically the name of the game, the year, and some arbitrary dollar value that he had made up, and I do mean that made up part. Probably because he was buying a lot of games too, so all the stuff that he needed, he had priced really low, and all the stuff that he had already owned that he wanted to sell, he had priced really high, but that's Larry. That's kind of how what he does. But he only printed one edition of this, and the book's at least 10 years old, but people still quote from it, even though it's totally inaccurate as far as pricing goes. But it was just kind of interesting that was really the only basis I had to go by. And then I went out and tried to find pictures of stuff and information on it. And there wasn't a ton of people that knew a lot about it. Now, more websites have developed. I've got one at marvin3m.com/arcade that's all about EM arcade games. So why don't you hit the next slide? Okay, so, the big question is when did EM arcade games come about? Really the first games were like in Midway style stuff, like at, when I don't mean the Midway game company, I mean Midway games at Coney Island there would be, something called a Midway, which was basically their terminology for an outdoor arcade, we're on a boardwalk, they call that the Midway. So you'll hear me refer to that, and I don't mean Midway Manufacturing, I mean, Midway Games. I just want to make that clear. So what were the first games were mostly, like, besides slot machines, were basically fortune tellers, peep shows, and Nickelodeons. And Nickelodeons are basically you put money in, and they're mechanized music boxes, more or less. Maybe there's a cymbal and a drum and maybe some xylophone-type stuff that it plays a tune through, some sort of hydraulics that it reads off off a page. We won't be talking about Nickelodeons. I don't really know anything about them. That's why we're not going to be talking about them. Marvin Yagoda would be a good guy if you're interested in that kind of stuff. So, like, fortune tellers go back pretty far. Actually, like, mechanical fortune tellers, you see, pre-electricity. But the one that really hit the map was known as the Cleveland Grandma. Now, this was invented by this guy named William Gent. Of Cleveland, Ohio, hence the Cleveland Grandma. And he had his own company, and he made these things. And it's hard to find a picture of one that's still original because these are things that were used, literally from 1929 till today. As a matter of fact, I went to Santa Cruz today, and there's a boardwalk there. And they had a Cleveland Grandma. Now, how original was it? I would say it was pretty unoriginal. But it looked like... at one time it was an original 1930s, Cleveland Grandma. So, there's places that are still operating these things. Here it is 70, 80 years old and they're still running it. That's how, like, timeless these things really were. And the thing that was magic about this is that her hands moved, her eyes moved, her head moved, she breathed. And this was all done through one motor. And here's, like, the internals of the whole thing. So you've got this aluminum thing here. And that's actually a card stacker for the fortune cards. And the way the device works is that they're kind of laid out perpendicular to each other, which is a real pain in the ass to fill the thing with cards because you've got to do it manually. But that's how they, you know, how they worked. And then you had a single motor that would rotate that thing, that would drop the cart down, and the single motor would also make everything through mechanical armatures and that make her eyes move and her hand move and her breathe and her head move. There are some older fortune tellers, and these were the Rover Brothers style. Donkey Wonder was the one that was best known. And you can see on this one that some of these are pre-electricity. They actually have little like crank handles where you're almost like kind of winding them up, so to speak. You know, these were the real, real early fortune tellers. These are worth some money, but again, these are, you know, obviously you're not going to... All these games are going to be hard to find in any sort of original condition. A couple of these, actually, I think the one on the right, the Puss in Boots, I believe that's a complete ground-up remake of the original, where I think the two on the left have some semblance of being original. Probably the one on the furthest left is more so than the one in the middle. Now, through the 40s, you know, and after the war... Genko kind of got into fortune tellers, and Genko put out this one called the Pedestal, and the Pedestal Grandma. And this was a great fortune teller because A, it was small, B, it was cheap, C, it was new. So, you know, this came out, you know, 56, 57, and prior to that, you know, people were running Cleveland Grandmas from the 30s, and they're probably getting old and tired. So this was like a pleasant surprise. And this is one of the most animated fortune tellers that was ever made, and it's a really small package. And you know what? They're not terribly expensive. To kind of give a point of reference, like if you were going to find a Cleveland Grandma today, you probably have to pay, I would suspect, around $20,000 for one. Well, you know, these little Genkos you can usually find for, you know, $3,000 to $6,000, depending on, you know, what kind of condition it's in. So then there were some other ones in the 40s and 50s that were like more modernistic versions of the Cleveland Grandma, you know, mostly made by Mutoscope, Decca, and Exhibit Supply. And then you get Mike Munvies kind of thrown into the mix. Mike Munvies was like a game distributor in New York City, but they also sometimes made their own games, and they also were in the business of taking old games and repainting them and, quote, making them new and then reselling them, you know, not as new equipment but as refurbished equipment. And they, so a lot of times you'll see games that have been repainted. My favorite is this one on the left, Wizard's Pen. So what you would do is you'd put your hand down on it, you put some money in it, and this little device would be like a pen, and it would look like it was writing on something. You know, it was like an automated pen. And then it would dispense out a card that it made look like it had just written for you, and it would be your fortune. Also was is all the cards were pre-drawn, and so it was just a magic trick, more or less. But it's kind of a neat effect. Then you got into the 60s, and you get like the Zoltan, not to be confused with Zoltar from the movie Big, and like Astro Data, which became fortune tellers that didn't have all the animated figurines in them, but they were more about light and sound. So like Zoltar actually had like a mechanical device, recording device in it, where he would spit back your fortune, and there was, you know, 12 different fortunes. You'd press the button on the front based on what month you were born, but really that was a farce too. It was just playing sequentially, so it didn't really matter what button you pressed. They were all in series. And then Astro Data, you know, same type of thing. It would print out like a computer card, like a computer punch card with your fortune on it. So, you know, you kind of get these kind of 60s-ish, you know, fortune tellers that you know, they've kind of left behind, you know, the old school fortune tellers. So then you come up into the present day, and this is Zoltar that somebody made up with this name that, you know, from the movie Big. They're trying to capitalize on the movie Big, obviously. And what this is a brand new fortune teller made to look like an old one. But it's run pretty much the same way. Here's the guts of it. So it's got a ticket dispenser. It's got an animatronics unit, which basically is the stuff that like Disney uses for those, you know, the pirates and Pirates of the Caribbean thing. You know, or at least that's what they used, you know, during the 90s. And it makes the guy move his hand and move his head and move his eyes and spit out a card. And he talks. So it's kind of like, you know, taking everything and grinding it into one big machine. You can see I'm there as a point of reference to kind of give you an idea for size. you know, that these are big, and you can buy these brand new, and they're not cheap. They're like $8,000, but they're available. And you see them, like, again, when I was in Santa Cruz, I saw some new ones there that they had, not by this company, but by some other companies. So they're still making, you know, fortune tellers even today. Oh, here's the guts of the Genko, her without her dress. You can see all the, like, the little armatures, and it's all run by a single multi-products motor that basically uses cams to move her arms and move her head and everything. It's kind of weird looking when she's disrobed like that. And then I have a picture of Pepe the Clown, not really a fortune teller at all, but it's kind of like a fortune teller that you get involved with. That is, the player can press those buttons to make the little guy dance, the little doll dance, and it plays a song, and it's kind of cute. But it's a mainstay classic arcade thing that you see, and, you know, even today I see Pepe's the Clowns, you know, still being run. There's one at Cedar Point in Sandusky, Ohio, at that amusement park. So, you know, it's just amazing that these things have lasted so long that, you know, they're almost timeless. So now a lot of people will ask, you know, should I have a fortune teller in my game room? And, I it's kind of hard for me to answer. I have them mostly because I got them cheap. You know, used, like I said, they're thousands of dollars. Not Pepe, but the other ones are. The ones that dispense cards that are actually genuine fortune tellers. And, you know, I can't personally justify spending that much money on them. But if you can get one inexpensively, I think they're cute to have. But it's the type of thing, like, you put a quarter in it once, you get your fortune once, and you're like, okay, I'm kind of done. You know what I mean? It's not something you go back to play. But I think it's interesting, and depending on what you're trying to do with your home game room, you know, I think it could be a good thing. You know, but I kind of feel that way about jukeboxes too. You know, I see people that I go to people's game rooms and they'll have 10 jukeboxes. And I'm like, what do you have? Dueling jukeboxes? You have them all playing the same song and you try and synchronize them? Or do you have them playing 10 different songs and, you know, they try and just walk on top of each other? You know, I could never understand how people would have a lot of jukeboxes in a game room. But believe me, there's guys like that. And there's certainly guys that have a lot of fortune tellers, too, I'm sure. So then the next thing in that was big in an early coin-operated device was mutoscopes. So what's a mutoscope? A mutoscope is basically a movie projector done with a set of about 1,500 pictures taken in sequence. And then you basically turn a handle and there's a light that shines that lets you see the pictures, and how fast it goes is how fast you turn the handle. And, you know, these came out very, very early in the, you know, like in the late 1800s, and they had like a wood box. And then by 1899 or so, they came up with this thing called a clamshell. So here, like on the left here, this is like a clamshell. They made these to about 1910. These are worth a fair amount of money. This one's obviously restored. It would never look like that in original condition. And then they went to this kind of steel unit in like the 1920s, you know, sheet metal, as a lot of guys call it. And then the ones on the right are kind of the, quote, fancier ones that are like 1950s. But to be honest with you, they're all work exactly the same. You can see in that middle picture with the green border around it, is there's all the different cards, you know, that are photographs. And then there's a light bulb above it. You put your money in, the light bulb comes on for so many revolutions of the crank, and then the light bulb goes off. So you can't even watch the whole movie usually in one coin drop. And it's kind of like a way to, you know, to keep you getting money, is, you know, because a lot of times these movies would be, I don't want to say they'd be pornographic, but they would be, they'd be edgy. And a lot of times they'd lead you on to think that there was going to be some sort of pornographic thing. But a lot of times it was just a big joke and just a way to, you know, extract money from you. All right, now these are more interesting. I like these peep shows. You know, they had these very early on, and these are some later ones. These were from like the 1950s. The 3D one is really cool. There on the right is the 3D reel. So you've got two pictures of the girl taken at just slightly different angles, and then as you look through the eyeglass, you know, the way your left eye and your right eye see it, it looks three-dimensional. And it's really cool because the girls are, you know, a lot of times they're topless. Like this, the one on the left is the one I own. The one on the right was a restored one that was on eBay. And the girls are they're naked in this one. And I was kind of shocked when I bought it from the guy. I got it out of a guy in Flint, Michigan. And it's just interesting how much things have changed. I mean, like, if this was the equivalent of Playboy at the time, and then you look at, you know, Playboy today, it's like the women, they don't even look like they came from the same planet, you know. It's just interesting to see, kind of see, like, you know, almost like, I don't want to say normal people, but unenhanced people, you know, because now everybody that you would see in any sort of magazine today, God, even on the cover of People, everybody's, you know, enhanced, as it may be. Well, back then, you know, obviously, you know, they didn't have that option. So, you know, to me, it's just like a step back into this kind of R-rated zone in the 50s. And I just think it's really, really neat, but that's my sick perversion, probably not yours. Okay, so then the next thing that was very, very popular early on was gun games. And again, in the arcade midways, I'm sure you guys have seen this, where you go in and there's a whole line of guns, and there's guys standing behind the counter, and they're all hooked up to a big compressor, and they have this big tube, this metal tube, and it's filled with pellets, and they cram it into the stock. And then you could sit there, and they put a target up, and you know you can nail the target, or maybe there's bottles that you hit, or maybe there's, you know, little dolls that you got to hit. Well, you know, that was the, you know, the early midway stuff. Well, you know, then some genius came up and said, okay, so how can we make this work in a bar? I need something coin operated. So really the first coin operated ones were like these, what they call these ABT ones, you know, and they made those from 1925 to 1961. And they're basically non-electric, you know, games that propel a metal pellet inside this little box that you hit targets and you know, you get a gumball on some of them. These two on the outside, they show gumballs. The one in the center, you don't get a gumball. So, you know, it's just kind of interesting. But, you know, I never really liked them because they always seem, I don't know, they kind of seem boring to me. But, you know, they're kind of like a stepping stone in time for gun games. And now they did make some motorized ones. They're pretty rare. But they did make them, and those ones I find more interesting, but they're really hard to find. You know, for every, you know, 100 models, they had millions of different models of these ABTs, and they only had like two that were electrified. So they're pretty hard to find, electrified ones. Okay, then in the 30s, you came up with Seberg, who was a jukebox manufacturer, and they came up with this thing called the Seberg multi-game Rayolite rifle range. And they call it multi-game because you could convert it to other themes. But it basically worked the same. The gun and the gun stand were separate from the target unit by maybe 20, 25 foot of cord, much like the cord on this microphone. And you basically were holding a giant flashlight that looked like a rifle. And you would shoot an electric eye that went through a Seberg type tube amplifier that would score your targets. Here was the most popular one that they sold. This one was called Chicken Sam, and this was, you know, 1939. And by the time the movies came, by the time World War II came, you know, all these things, you know, they couldn't make them again. So, you know, during the war, so they had conversions, and you see ray gun conversion kits. And those were pretty generic ones. The one up top was more war themed. You know, they had, you know, Kill the Jap and other Hitler and Mussolini style, you know, Kill the Hitler guy type themes that they would convert these during the war. And then after the war, this was the big one that you see. That's kind of the arcade classic, Shoot the Bear. And how this one was a little different is when you shot the bear would actually stand up on his rear hinds. He'd turn around and go in the opposite direction, but he would also growl. So, you know, Seberg thought, okay, so we got this amplifier unit that you can see in the bottom of the unit there, and why can't we make it make some noise? So they made some, like, almost like, it sounds kind of like a white noise almost. But, you know, if you've got an imagination, I guess it's what a bear sounds like, kind of. And, you know, so they came up with Shoot the Bear, and this is kind of like the mainstay. You see this in a lot of people selling them and buying them, but they're really hard to find. They made a crap load of them, but they're really hard to find in any sort of original condition, and they usually need a ton of work. As a matter of fact, I don't think I've ever seen anybody sell one that's been restored. Not that, you know, they're not out there, but obviously they are and people keep them. But I bought one. I bought this one here, Coon Hunt, from a guy. And it was really cheap. And I couldn't figure out why until I got the game. This is Coon Hunt. So you got two trees that these raccoons go up and down. And when you hit them, they again squeal. You know, like you're shooting a raccoon. And the guy told me when I bought it, he said, yeah, it's kind of a parts game, but, you know, the tails are missing on the raccoons. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to include some new tails for you. And I'm like, great. I don't know where the guy got NOS, you know, new old stock tails for a game that came out in 1954. But, yeah, that's great. So I get the game, and I'm unwrapping it in my driveway because it's got all the shrink wrap around it from the, you know, from North American Van Lines. And as I unwrap it, this stench just is peeling off this thing. And I'm like, what the hell is, what is going on? And I open it up, and there's this bag in the bottom of it. And I open it up, and there's four raccoon tails in it. The guy wasn't shitting me. They were real raccoon tails that he actually cut off raccoons and put in this bag. So they were just like rotting in this bag. And it was the most disgusting thing I think I ever bought. I bought games with dead animals in it, but this was way worse. And the whole game just skank. I couldn't get rid of the thing fast enough, needless to say. But anyways, it's kind of a cool game. Beside that. Now, here's another one. This one came out in 1958. This is, again, more of a Midway-style game, but this was made by Chicago Coin called, you know, the Commando Machine Gun. And what's interesting is that this shoots little pellets. They're bigger than BBs, like from a BB gun. And they use that motor. You can see that big gray motor in the one that's got the case off. And it's cool. Tim Arnold has one of these. He used to have it set up back in his shed, and he didn't have, like, this whole unit. He just had the guns. So he went through the guns, and he had the BBs. He had, like, you know, 100,000 BBs, and he made this big, maybe half the size of this room. No, I would say half, maybe a third of the size of this room, and he fenced it all in with 2x4s and put plastic sheathing all around it, and then he hung, like, Barbies from it. You know, like on little strings, and you would sit there with and little toy cars and you know, and G.I. Joes and stuff like that he had hanging, and you'd sit there and just pummel the shit out of them with this thing that was like unbelievable. It's really, really cool. I mean, it obviously doesn't look as cool as that one picture with the blue border around it, but it was still really neat. And allegedly, he's going to move that to the Pinball Hall of Fame at some time. But every once in a while, you do see these on eBay. I've seen them on eBay, new old stock, still in the crate. And these were $1,000 per gun, brand new.
Excuse me.
And it's just interesting every once in a while that they turn up. And, you know, Tim had to go through them and you know, oil them and work on them. But I guess they're pretty robust. Okay, now, in the 60s, the whole rail light style of gun was still being made. This one on the left, the ray gun, that's actually my game right there. It's not working, but someday I hope it will be. It's kind of neat. It's got animals that go by, and as you hit the duck, then a goose appears. And then you hit the goose, a rabbit appears. And then you hit the rabbit, and then a squirrel appears. And then those two kind of round things up there, those things just kind of spin, and you can hit them, but they don't move where the other animals move. It's kind of a neat thing. It's big, and it's huge, and it weighs a ton. I can see why they didn't make them much after this. But Chicago Coin made these basically in 61. They made these two styles, the Wild West and the Railgun. And that was pretty much the end of the rail light until like the mid-70s, and we'll come back to that in a minute. So then the next thing in the big gun game thing was this thing called the Dale gun. So, you know, Gent and Fee came up with this idea that you could shoot a gun without actually shooting anything, and you just had contact points that lined up. So as a target would go across a piece of scenery, you know, it would have wipers, and the wipers would go past little segmentations, and if those lined up with the gun, which had two radiuses as you moved it, and all these things went in line and you could get electrical circuit going by it, you could actually drop the target or you could score points or both. And they came up with this concept. Well, then Dale thought, okay, fine, we'll take that concept and then using mirrors, we'll build this gun that you know, it's 6 feet high, but it's only 2 feet deep, and it'll make it look like you're 8 feet away using mirrors. And that's what's known as the Dale gun. And that's basically what all the mechanical gun games from, you know, the late 40s up till the mid 70s really looked like. So, you know, there were some other gun games that weren't necessarily in that style. The one on the right is a Dale gun, the Davy Crockett. That's a Genco game. The one on the bottom left, the Moon Raiders, that's a Bally from 1958. That's a Dale gun game. So it's using the wipers and it's using the mirrors to give you this depth of perception in kind of a small package. But then you also got some other kind of weirder gun games, like the Tommy gun, which is basically a big flashlight and wipers where you shoot a rotary planes going around in a circle, and once again using wipers. And the one right here, the Kinney Air Raider, the black and white picture, that's pretty much the same sort of deal too. That one's from 1939, the Tommy gun's from 1941, the Davy Crockett's from, I think, 54, and the Moon Raider's from 58. So you got all these kind of gun games, and they're kind of similar, but they're not. And, you know, they used a lot of imagination, and they're kind of neat. You know, the Air Raiders is really cool, but it's kind of big and kind of expensive. The last one that I knew that sold was fully restored, and it went for $15,000. That's a lot of money. And compared to like the Moon Raiders, which, you know, is probably, you know, $800, and Davy Crockett's probably $500, you know, so Ron hit it for me. And then you moved into, you know, like these kind of 70s style ones. And another thing happened in 64, they came up with a great idea that we could put black lights in there, which again adds more depth of percent, you know, more depth, to the whole package, where you have everything painted with fluorescent lights. And you use a black light to kind of highlight it. It adds a really cool look. So all this stuff, you know, after 64 has that effect. Everybody jumped on that bandwagon, and it worked really well. And the other thing that happened kind of like mid-70s is they went to like a light system where instead of using the wipers to score, they actually, the guns became, again, flashlights, much like the rail lights. I personally don't like those as much. I kind of like the wiper ones. They're just kind of easier to deal with. The problem with the ones that use the light system is that the photo sensors kind of wear out and over time, and they're hard to get replacements. So they're just harder to work on. Where the wiper things, if a wiper breaks, you know, that's fairly easy to repair. And, you know, it's just standard electromechanical work like you'd do on a pinball machine. It's just big stepper units is really all it is. But, you know, and then they added 8-tracks. And electronic sound. After about 68, all gun games had electronic sound, you know, so maybe they had, you know, when you hit something, it would squeal, some sort of sick white noise that they used a little circuit board and some discrete components to, you know, to make noises, or tank noises, to, you know, to make a boom, 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 boom noise. You know, some of them even had, like, gun noises. They all had, these 61s had recoil, so when you pulled the trigger, they would have, like, 110-volt coil, you know, kind of, like, underneath the counter that would kick the gun stock like you were actually shooting. They're fairly realistic for what they are. You know, obviously they're not like, you know, what you would play on your Xbox today, but, you know, I think they're cool snapshots in time. And the other thing is, like, ambush was really politically incorrect. You're shooting you know, little Oriental guys, kind of like you're in Vietnam. You know, so it was definitely a whole snapshot in time. Bonanza, you know, you're shooting Indians. You never buy a gun game where you're shooting Indians today. Twin Rifles was pretty generic, where you're just shooting animals. That one you could remake today. But these other two on the left and in the middle, you never see anything like that today. It would just be political suicide to sell something like that today. Then another style of gun game was ones that, again, shot projectiles. This is, again, moving back to the mid, you know, to the midways of, like, Coney Islands and that. Well, they would shoot little nylon pellets. These are pretty cool games. You know, you actually have to knock the target over, and then you would score points, and you're shooting little animals or little clowns, and these are good games. They came out starting about 1960, and I think the last one was the color picture down here, which was the Midway White Lightning. I think that came out in 69, And that was pretty much the only time you saw these. They didn't make a ton of them, but they are really fun. And they're very realistic because you're actually shooting something, you know, out of the gun, and you're actually physically hitting something, not physically knocking down a target. So they are very realistic. And then what they use is basically a shop vac. It sucks and it blows is basically what it's doing to move the pellets. It sucks them coming into the unit and then blows them going out the gun. So, you know, and it's just using, like, when you pull the trigger, it basically turns the vacuum on for, like, 2 seconds. So there's a kind of a slight delay almost because the vacuum comes on quickly, but you pull the trigger and it goes, like, literally that fast. But there's that little bit of delay as the motor kind of comes up to speed and shoots the pellet out. So you kind of got to have the right timing down. But it's cool. I really like this style of game. Okay, now the next thing that was real popular in America was bowling, and this was another mainstay of the arcades. But this was a little later, where the gun games and the fortune tellers and the peep shows and the mutoscopes were definitely an earlier thing. Bowling became much more popular. Well, it was popular in the 30s as just a general sport, but it also became popular in the arcades with this game. This is the 1939 Evans 10 Strike, which is a mannequin game. Mannequin just means that you have basically a 6-inch little metal man that, you know, is pretending to be you inside the game. You know, it's kind of a weird transition to think of that you're a 6-inch little man painted with an ugly green shirt holding a bowling ball. But that's really all it's doing. And it's a great game, but it did have some limitations. That is, it was, you know, didn't score regulation. It basically gave you 30 points for a spare and 30 points for a strike and 20 points for a spare and 5 frames for the game. But it's a great game, and they made it for a long time. They made it, you know, from 1939. They obviously didn't make it during World War II. And then after the war, they made it up to 53. So you would think that there's a crap load of these out there, but they actually are kind of hard to find. But, you know, cool game. Another game that came out, another bowling game that was pretty neat, was in 1939. It's known as Bally Alley. So you see this big, giant silver ball thing on the front. You would put your hand in there, and it's kind of like would roll all around, and there's a button on the thumb. So you would turn it left or right to aim like a turret where this big 1.5-inch steel ball would be. And then you get it lined up where you want it, and you press the thumb button. And then as the ball is going down the alley, you could jerk the ball around, jerk your silver ball to the right or the left, and it would actually put English on the ball, and you could actually hook it. It's really stupid to hook it, though, to be honest with you. It's always better just to throw it straight, but it was really neat, you know, to do, because obviously you wouldn't have any of that control, you know, unless you were in a real bowling alley. And it was really kind of a neat game, and when you hit the pins would just kind of slide back behind curtains. They wouldn't actually fall. Like on the 10 strike, the pins actually had little strings on them, and when you hit them, and magnets in the bottom of them. So the magnets would hold the pin onto the lane, and then when you hit them, you basically were knocking the magnets off their steel, you know, receptacles, and then the pins would be spring-loaded and go up. Well, in this game, they would just go off to the side, you know, kind of like a magic trick behind these curtains. Okay, then we had World War II, and not much obviously happened during World War II. You know, there was really no manufacturing. Some games got converted, like, you know, the Evans 10 Strike would get converted. Bola Score was kind of a conversion, but none of the conversion games were really very big. But then after the war, they came up with this idea of bowling called a shuffle alley. Now, this is different than a shuffle board. A shuffle board is maybe a 20-foot long slab of maple with one guy standing on one end and you're on the other end, and you got a puck, and you got that magic kind of dust on it, and you kind of throw it down into like a triangle area, and you're trying to get points. The head of the triangle is worth more than the base of the triangle. You know, that's what's known as a shuffleboard. Well, this is different in that this is bowling with bowling rules. So you got 10 frames, and it uses 20-30 scoring again, you know, 30 points for a strike, 20 points for a spare. And when they first come out, they just had little pins that would light up as you started the frame. They'd all be lit, and then you'd throw the puck, and depending on what you hit, the pins that you hit would actually unlight, so you would know where you needed to aim. And they could, using, you know, playfield switches, they could, like, if you got a 7-10 split and you threw it just right and you hit the two switches just right, you know, you could make a 7-10 split, which you could never obviously do in bowling. I know bowling professionals that bowled their whole life and they never gotten a 7-10 split. You know what I mean? It's like an impossible shot. But here you could make it. You know, it's kind of fantasy land, but that's kind of what it's all about. So anyways, then just like a year later, 1950, 1951, they came up with disappearing pins. You can see this middle picture. It says now it's six player. The original one here was one player. Now they're at six player with the disappearing pins. You see the little pin hood, and they use little 6-inch pins. So as you slid down, the pins would do something called flyback. So they would just be on an arm, and they would just, you know, fly. You know, they'd fly back as the puck hit them. Those are the flyback pins. And you can see, like, the middle game has no score reels. This is all light box scoring, okay? And then you get to the right where now you've got score reels, and by 1956, they're scoring regulation. I don't know why they had such a hard time coming up with the methodology to do regulation, but apparently, you know, United really didn't do it until 1956. Well, late 1955, I guess, you know, on November 55. So it took him a little while to get the regulation thing going, which is weird because Gottlieb came out with this thing called Bolette, which is like a smaller version of all these single-player puck, and they scored regulation, but these guys couldn't get it, so it took them a little while. But anyways, they sold a crap load of these games. These were high-end games. They were the most expensive game in the line, sold by United, Chicago Coin, and Bally. Those were the big manufacturers with kind of Keeney, also sold a few. And then in 57, Williams came out with their own version of 10 Strike, or 10 Pins, as it may be. They came out with two games. 10 Strike was the replay. 10 Pins was the novelty version. And they also came out with a game in 5-foot version. The one on the left is 5-foot. The one on the right there is a 7-foot. And if you ever get a chance to get a 7-foot, it's much more fun than the 5-foot. It's a lot more challenging. It's a lot better game. But now, so what they did is Williams Evans basically went out of business in the mid-50s. So Williams bought the tooling for the little man, and they came up with a different pin set unit. And obviously the cabinet is completely different, and they added score reels, and they made the game two players. So they kind of updated the player. It still scores 20-30, you know, for spares and strikes. It isn't regulation, but it was a much, much more improved game over the Evans one. It also does 10 frames. Well, actually, it's switchable between 5 and 10 frames. You can shoot it either way. These are pretty easy to find. They sold a crap load of this game. Much, probably in a year, sold more of these than Evans ever sold of theirs. At least that's what it looks like from, you know, seeing them on, you know, eBay or whatever. You see a 10 strike comes up on eBay a lot, and Evans comes up almost never. Okay, another thing that happened in late 56 was an actual ball bowler. So, you know, this is like taking the next step of a shuffle alley. Instead of using a puck, let's go to balls. United had the head up over Bally and CCM. Bally and CCM didn't come out with a ball bowler until early 57. So United came up with this unit, you know, and pretty much had the market to themselves for a good 3-4 months. And again, this was the top end coin-op device that all the manufacturers sold. These were really expensive, but they made a crap load of money. And again, you're throwing balls instead of throwing a puck, and then the balls, you know, they go into a trough in the back, and then a motor lifts them up, and then they roll down that Oak Hill and come right back to the player. It's really a neat concept. The problem is that when it initially came out, they're 3-inch balls. They're pretty small. And if you look at the lane on the one on the right, you can really see it. Well, you can see it on both of them. There's no alley, or I mean, there's no gutters. I think I missaid that up there. There's no gutters. So that means that you could bank the ball. Like, I don't know if you guys ever take your kids bowling and they put up those things where it makes the gutters disappear. Well, it's kind of like that. You could do that kind of thing, but it's not real realistic. Yeah, it is pretty low, but then it got even lower. The reason why, you can see like where it says UMC in the front on the flyer on the left. All electronics, not all of it, but a lot of electronics is actually under the lane. The lane opens up like a casket. And then there's very little back in the head. They changed their mind on this, and they eventually moved everything to the head because they brought the lane down even lower. So now you can see Like here, this is a good comparison. The one on the right opens up like a casket. The one on the left does not. Okay, so you can see that the lane is actually lower on the one on the left because they don't have this area where they're putting electronics underneath the lane. So now, by 1958, you got ball size increasing to 4.5 inches, and everybody pretty much adopted that as the standard size. And then they did this thing called contact bowling. So what they did is, as the ball would roll under the pins, it would hit lane switches. So they changed their mind, and what they did is they made it so that you would actually, as you hit a pin and the pin moved back maybe an inch, it would close a switch, and then that would be the equivalent of a lane switch. But there would be no lane switch. They did this for a while, really only for 1958, maybe a couple games in 1959. But it really wasn't an effective system. It was pretty short-lived, these kind of things known as contact bowlers. Then they came up with another idea. Instead of using these flyaway pins, they came up with basically the idea, well, we saw Williams 10-strike and Evans 10-strike with pins with strings on them. Why can't we make a full-size bowler like that? So they came up with this idea. This was a United game. It's called Bowlerama. And you can see it on the right. There's a picture of it actually being played. There's a nice strike that somebody has just hit. And all the pins are actually going up, just like a 10-strike. And so instead of being like a flyaway pin, they're actually pins that actually retract from you hitting them. So the harder you throw the ball, and the more accurate you throw it, the better you're going to do. Now, that's unlike a flyaway pin system, where it doesn't matter how hard you throw the ball. It makes actually zero difference. If anything, it screws things up because the game can't react fast enough if you throw it too fast. Bowlerama, that's not the case. This is as close to real bowling as it ever got, but they only made this one machine, and this other one called the NBA, which was basically the same game, just remarketed by a different company. The problem with this game is these were like 20 feet long and 1,200 pounds. Yeah, real bitch to move and take up a lot of real estate. So, they basically only made those two models, the Bowlerama and the NBA. And then also in the late 50s, they made some other bowlers, like the one with the old geezer next to it. That's my dad. That's called the Pixie Bowler. So that used 2-inch balls, but it's a real small. It's only like 8 feet long. So if you didn't have a lot of room, that thing was just slightly longer than a pinball machine. Most pinball machines are about 5.5 feet long, so it's a little bit longer. And then they made this thing, Midget Alley. I didn't talk about this so much on the Bally Alley, but the way the Bally Alley worked is that it would rotate the ball in a stationary position at about 300 RPM, and then when you hit that red button, it would basically release the ball down the lane. And the way they did that is they would use a DC motor to spin the ball. So the ball is stationary, but it's spinning, 300 RPM. Then you hit the button to launch it, and it takes the rectifier out of the equation and converts the power going to the motor from AC to D, or from DC to AC. And what that does is, if you do that to a DC motor, it freaks it out. It just like stops it dead. So then the ball is spinning at 300 RPM. All of a sudden the motor just stops. The thing kind of does like a burnout and goes down the lane. And that's what Midget Alley and Bally Alley did to propel the ball down the lane. And it was really neat because, you had a turret where you could, aim the ball, and then you press the button and bam, it would go down. It would go shooting down the lane and hit the pins and then roll back like a ball bowler back to the turret. Now, the thing that was neat about Midget Alley is they added another feature, because on Bally Alley, you could find the sweet spot. And once you find the sweet spot, as long as you don't put the English on it, you could just kind of hold it there and press it and the ball would come back. You don't move your hand. Press it, you get another strike. Ball comes back, don't move your hand. Press it. You could get all these strikes in a row. So what they did on Midget Alley is they put a set of motors in there so that if you hold it in one position, the motor physically turns the turret for you, whether you want it to or not. So you have to re-aim every shot, which was kind of interesting. It's kind of like they didn't want you to cheat. And then you have this All-Star Bowler, which was made by Bally, and this was also a turret system. And this was a little bit different of a turret system, where it would just go back and forth like this, and you had no control over it. So you would have to time the shot So you'd want to hit it like where it was pretty much dead center, and then you push that lever, and it would like shoot the ball down the lane, like almost like a catapult. And that's a really cool game, actually. If you ever get a chance to play one of those, it's a great game. So they kind of came out with these slight deviations in the late 50s of bowlers. Then they, you know, the contact bowler and the bowlerama were short-lived. They kind of went back to the lane switches and the 4.5 inch ball, and then they came up with different games. And one of the different games they came up with was flash. So you've got this thing with flash is like a timing issue. So not only are you trying to throw a strike, but you're also trying to throw a strike at the right time. As they have a motorized stepper unit that would show different score values. So you'd want to time your shot so when as soon as it hits the first lane switch, the score is at the highest point. And that was called flash, and that was a really, really popular system of scoring. And they came up with other different games that were like really stupid. This, like you can see over here, progressive scoring, advanced scoring, mystery, strikes and spares. Those are all pretty stupid. The only ones you end up really playing is regulation and flash. You know, all the other ones I could do without. But you can see the cabinet styles kind of progressed, and they as the 60s moved on, they got really ugly. I like Majestic, the Chicago Coin. That's like my favorite ball bowler. It's 4.5 inches, 4.5 inch balls. It plays all the good games, you know, the flash and the regulation. It's got lane switches. I don't have to deal with the contact bowler thing. It's a decent looking game. All the lanes are pickled oak, and you know it's good hardwood, and it's a good solid running game. But then they went to this thing like Supersonic, where they got this gooseneck system, and it's getting ugly. And even United, you know, have these giant pin hoods. The games kind of as went through the 60s, they got uglier and uglier. And then they got pointy art, you know, and the Christian Marsh style of art. And it just got uglier and uglier. But by 1972, ball bowlers were pretty much gone, pretty much because I think they figured that at 16 feet and 800 pounds that it was just too much. Too much real estate. I don't know if people were stealing the balls. There's a story that a patron dropped one of the balls on their foot and sued United and won the suit, and that was another reason why they stopped making ball. That's a rumor. I've never been able to substantiate that. So I guess there was a lot of reasons why ball bowlers went away by 72, and the only thing you could find was puck bowlers. And they still made puck bowlers, Williams/United, because Williams and United was the same company after 1964. They made puck bowlers up to the dot matrix era. There's a puck bowler made as late as, I think, 1994, 95 by Williams. So they still made them. In the early 70s, the mannequin bowler came back out as a thing called mini bowl by Williams. Much uglier cabinet. The ball now, instead of rolling down the lane like a ball bowler, comes underneath it. So it's not quite as cute, but the good news is that it scores regulation. So it's more realistic. Sega, who was also making games, Sega, they came out with a thing called Pro Bowler, which was a direct copy of the Mini Bowl. But neither of these games sold in big numbers because they're pretty hard to find. You don't see many Mini Bowls or Pro Bowlers for sale. They're pretty tough to find. So they didn't have the popularity of the 10-strike. And you see in this lower picture, you see the Pro Bowler, and right next to it is a 5-foot 10-strike. So you can kind of see there's, you know, a huge difference in cabinet styling, even though it's, you know, essentially the same game. Other mannequin games. You know, you keep coming up with this mannequin, and you notice the weird spelling of mannequin. Why is mannequin spelled like that? It's not the correct spelling of mannequin. Well, it's spelled like that because the manufacturers of these games spelled it like that. So just to keep with it. You know, normally mannequin has a Q-U in it, not a K-I, which is kind of weird, but that's how they spelled it. But anyways, you know, basketball was a great theme for mannequin games. It translated well to, you know, to that footprint and that philosophy. And the first game that really came out that was a good basketball game was this Chicago Coin basketball champ on the left. And basically you had a guy, he got delivered the ball. You couldn't aim the guy. All you had to do was time your shot and how hard you threw it, and then there would be a defender that would go back and forth. Kind of a stupid game. But people, it's iconic. People love that game. They really like it. Personally, I'm not a big fan of it. Then in 54, Genko came out with the two-player basketball. Much better game. You can aim the guys left and right. You're can play two players, so you can, or you can play one player, either way. So you're playing against somebody, and you can score points for your opponent. If you miss your shot, you know, so there's like red baskets and green baskets. If you miss your shot, you can score points for him. See right here, you see there's the two guys, and notice the baskets. You got red and you got green, and then you got different point levels. Right now you've got the outside baskets are 2 points, and the two center baskets are 4 points. So if you're the green guy on the right and you want to get the most points, you've got to shoot kind of cross scale to get at that green basket for the 4 points. Well, that's kind of risky. Or you could take the safe shot for the 2 points, okay? And if you were gutsy and you wanted to go for the four-point basket and you missed and put it in the red basket, you would score points for the other guy. So it was pretty cool. It's actually, you know, pretty unrealistic as far as basketball goes. But, you know, still, it's a great competitive game when you're playing against somebody. And that's why, it's just a game that everybody seems to want. And it was actually reissued, maybe in the late 90s by Benchmark. They made a version of this, kind of like they made a version of 10 Strike. Benchmark Industries out of Florida, they reissued 10 Strike too. The only problem with those reissues is they're all made in China, so they're really kind of cheap materials. But, you know, they're really not that much cheaper than the originals. Some other Mannequin Games, golf was really, really popular for Mannequin Games. Three games that come to mind is Hollywood Driving Range, which was kind of like a pitch and bat style golf game. But the one that everybody wants is mini golf. So mini golf is like a two-player game. It's the picture of the guy in the upper right-hand corner. You can see the different holes. So you first got to shoot the hole one, then hole two, three, four. It's a nine-hole course. So you got to hit them very linearly. So it's kind of a goofy game. And again, I don't find it one that I keep going back to. I actually like Hollywood Driving Range is, to me, a much tougher game. But, again, this mini golf is iconic. And they also came out with a single-player version called Southland Engineering Little Pro, which is basically the exact same thing as mini golf, just a one-player version. It's about half the price of mini golf, too. Here's the Little Pro. You can see how ugly it is. I don't know what they were thinking with the Formica cabinet, and the artwork. That girl with the silver hair. I don't know. You know, most of the time when I see girls with silver hair, they're like 70, 80 years old. You know, they sure don't. Yeah, whatever. And then Bromley reissued the game in 91 or 92. It says 90 up there, but I think it's actually 91. And they added some more obstacles to it. So here you still got the linear thing. You see, shoot one, it's really easy. Then you got to shoot two, that's pretty easy. Then, you know, you things get trickier. You know, you got a windmill, you got a ramp you got to go up, you got a little castle you got to hit, you know. So, it, you know, they kind of did a reissue of the game, which is interesting. And it's got really bad sound. It's almost annoying. But, yeah, it is what it is. Anyways, other Mannequin Games, boy, if anybody has any of these, God, please see me. I've been looking for any one of these three games for like 15 years, and I haven't been able to find them. Or I haven't been able to find them for a reasonable price. Maybe I should say that. But anyway, so you've got these things called skee-ball. Everybody's played skee-ball. Skee-ball has been around since the 1920s. Again, it was a favorite of Midway arcade games. Personally, I hate it. To me, it's like ball-less bowling. I mean, there's no pins that you're hitting. You just got to get it in these holes. Kids love it. I think it's stupid. But the mannequin version, I think, is really cool. I don't know why, but I guess, you know, the little 8-inch man really does something for me. I can paint him as a chick or something. I don't know. A cross-dressing skee-ball mannequin. But anyways, these games, maybe I'm really enthralled with these games because I can't have them. I'm not really sure. But I the only guy I know that has anything is a guy in Colorado has both the CCM skee ball in the middle, and I think that's actually his game that I took at his game room. And he actually just got the Gottlieb one on the right, the skee ball at, which makes me sick that he's got two and I got zero. But he has them. And the one on the right is probably, you know, is rare. I only ever heard of one other one. And he actually ended up buying two from a guy, which is just sick. Why he needs two and he won't sell me one, I have no idea. But anyways, if anybody ever sees one of those and they don't want it for themselves, I would love to buy it from you. Other cool games is that worked well with the mannequins. And again, ones that I'm looking for are this Mutisco KO Champ on the upper left. It's kind of a neat game where you're actually boxing. It's kind of like Rock'em Sock'em Robots in a coin-op version. The Silver Gloves is very similar to the KO Champ, just in a slightly different format, more of an upright-style cabinet. But the one that preceded all of these is the one in the middle. That one's completely non-electric. The only thing that's electric in the one in the middle is the light that's on top. And it's all just purely mechanical. That game actually comes up. The one in the center actually comes up fairly often. You see them for sale. They made a lot of them. Came out pretty early, 1928. So it's one of the first mannequin games ever made. Other mannequin games, they even did some gun games with little mannequins. This one's a Sega Gunfight. Kind of interesting game. It uses light optics. The cactuses fall over if you shoot them. You know, they like cut themselves in half and fall over. And if you hit your guy, he falls over and dies. It's kind of a cute little mannequin gun game. So, you know, they made a lot of different mannequin games. Hit it, Ron. Mechanical driving games. Oh, boy. I can't tell you how stupid it is to play a driving game that doesn't have a video screen. But on the other hand, I have two out of the three of these games that are on this page. So, I, you know, stupid or not, driving is like, you know, what we're all about here in America. And so, you know, you're just drawn to car games. I don't know why that is. But the one on the left, Speedway, is basically slot cars. But it's like pussy slot cars because 'cause you can't take the car. The cars don't ever come off the track. So what happens is that on the straightaway you keep the steering wheel straight. As long as you got the steering wheel straight, you got full power to the cars. As the cars hit the corner, say you got the wheels, it's still straight. Well, the car just dies because the contacts switch and you got to turn your steering wheel to the left to make the completion for power for that left turn. And then it goes around the corner, and you're still turning left, comes out of the corner, and the car dies again because you got to straighten the wheel back out to the center, and then power returns back to the wheels. So it's kind of like this slot car like I've never ever heard of in a coin-operated version, and the cars never come off the track. It's all about timing. But it's still kind of an unusual game, but again, it's probably not one you're going to go back and forth or back to too many times. The one on the right, Mutoscope, it's called Drive Yourself. I call it Drive Yourself Crazy. It's kind of cute. It looks a lot better than it is. And you've got this little car that's on a drum. The car's stationary. When you turn the wheel, the car moves left and right, but it doesn't move forward or back. And then what happens is the background scenery drum moves to give you this illusion that it's moving. But you're sitting in this giant apparatus that kind of looks like a car, and it's kind of a good-looking game, but, you know, it plays okay. It's interesting. The most interesting one is the one I don't have, is the one in the center. That one's called Motorama. So you've got this 57 Plymouth model car, and you're basically trying to drive it around this course in a set amount of time, and you're trying to get all around the United States. And so you've got numbered targets that you actually have to touch with your bumpers. You know, so you know, target number one lights up. You got to drive your car to target number one, and you got to hit it. It's like a stand-up pinball target. You got to hit it, then target number two lights. That's completely on the other side of the field, and so then you got to drive your car over there. And you know, so you got your car, and you got a throttle, and it's kind of a cute game. That one actually is pretty difficult. It's linear though. A lot of these games I find that are linear, like the mini golf and stuff like that. You know, you find that the first few objectives are fairly easy, and then it gets progressively harder and harder, and it's like you can only get so far in the game, and it seems like it becomes impossible. That's why people don't like games like Red and Ted's Roadshows, because it's linear. Well, these are kind of the same way, but this is a lot more interesting than Red and Ted Roadshow. You can tell I'm not a big fan of that game. All right, so there's some other games, too. that came out more in the 70s. These are ones, I guess, are a little more realistic, like the Casco Untouchables. That's actually a Japanese game where you can see in the bottom bottom center, you're the car, the black and white car, and the guys up front are gangsters shooting back at you. So what happens is you're on a giant conveyor belt, and you can speed up. The red car is kind of stationary. It moves left and right, but not forward and back. And you try, and as you hit the gas, you move closer to them, but you can't hit them. And you're trying to line up and shoot them. It's kind of an interesting game. And then you've got the motorcycle, the Chicago Coin motorcycle, and its twin game called Speedway, which is basically the same game but with cars. And again, it uses rotating drums. You can see the picture in the upper right. That's actually a kind of cool game. I like that. The motorcycle one. I like it better than the Speedway. So, these are kind of cute driving games, but, none of this stuff is really very realistic until, like, you actually get a video screen involved, like real driving games like you see today, that actually feel like you're driving. Okay, now, you see, we're kind of at the end, Ron. This is the last genre we're going to hit is baseball games. So baseball, as American as apple pie, all that kind of stuff. You got this game that came out, invented by George Minor, called All-American Baseball. And most people don't talk about this game. They always talk about its twin brother made by Racola, known as the World Series in 37. But this was really the game that started the whole pitch and bat thing. And it came out in 29. They made it between 29 and 31. And then what happened in 31? Big thing happened in 31. Pinball. Okay, so this is like before pinball, but it's using balls and a bat. And it's actually, the bat is kind of a flipper. I don't know, it's just something to think about. But, so you get pinball, and then, I don't know, Amusement Machine Corporation couldn't make the transition or whatever, I don't know why. And they ended up selling all the rights and tooling to Harry Williams in 1931. So then Harry was hired by Bally, and Bally was going to remake the game. But Minor, who was like under contract, got killed in an airplane crash, and then so Harry was the man. And then Harry got hired over by Racola as their chief pinball designer, and of course he brought all his patents with him. So then he ended up in 1937 with the Racola World Series. This is the quintessential coin-op game. This is about $30,000 to $50,000 for a restored unit. They're worth a lot, no doubt. And this is, they only made it in 37, and it's got the actual player names from 37s. All the guys that were playing. Babe Ruth is on the play field somewhere. It kept track of balls and strikes and outs, and obviously hits and bases, or hits and runs. It's really cool. It's got like 10 different pitches. It's just a really, really neat game. I don't know if you've ever seen one or played one. It's really unique. Is it worth that much money? Obviously not. That's really stupid money. But, I know several people that paid that much for it to get their copies. So I'm sure the economy's probably affected this game. But anyways, those are the thing that really got it all starting. In Racola, before they got Harry Williams, they came out with this game. This is actually pictures of the game that's out on the floor. This is Dan Miller's game. This is the 34 Racola World Series. This is kind of a neat. It's pinball combined with baseball. So you plunge the ball around, and basically if you get a hit, the ball ends up on that little green play field, and the whole play field kind of turns as your guy rounds the bases. So there's home plate. It's kind of backwards. You would think that where second base is where you're standing. You would think that would be home plate, but on this game, it's kind of ass backwards. So it rotates counterclockwise, not clockwise, which is right. I mean, that's the right way for it to rotate, but it just, the whole thing seems really, really odd. But it is really kind of a cool mechanical game. And, this was the predecessor to, we got to, of course, the 37 World Series. And then you had some other cool games that came out right before the war, too. The Westerns Deluxe Baseball, which was Steve Kordak. Helped design that game. That was pretty popular. The one in the middle is pretty neat, Kenny Texas Leaguer. So basically what you do is you have a motor that drives these little balls up to the on the back of the game, and then it comes down like a ski ramp, and then it comes off the ski ramp for about 3 or 4 inches in the air, and then you got to hit it with a mechanical bat. And then you knock it into, you see where it says 1, 2, 3, 1? Those are like how many runs you can get, which is, you know, for your hit. And then it drops the balls into that little silver plate that you kind of see below it. And then you can kind of add up your score. And then scientific batting practice came out a year later where it basically automated all this. So you still have the same, much bigger format, it, you know, with little mannequins now on the play field where Texas Leaguer doesn't have mannequins. And, you know, it comes down the jump, you hit it, and then it actually keeps track of the score with a standard, you know, like backlit back glass. Then, of course, you had World War II. Nothing happened during then. And then after the war, this was the big game, Bat-a-score. So this is similar to throwing the ball in the air. The guy, the batter actually winds up, a ball actually comes up through him and then comes to his arm, and then his arm comes back in kind of like a non-humanistic move, but it comes around like this, and he throws it like that at your player, and then you got to hit it. It's the hardest damn game. It really is hard to get the knack of, but it's a great game. And this is a real expensive game too. I know somebody that's paid five figures to get a copy of one of these games. It doesn't come up for sale a lot. It makes me sick. This is the saddest story in the world. A guy pulled into my driveway once. He called me up on the phone. He says, "I got a baseball game. I just bought it at a garage sale for $65. I said, "Great. I love baseball games. Bring it over." And so he brings it over, and he shows up with a Bat-a-score. It's in his van. It's in my driveway in his van. And he says, "You know, I really want a Gottlieb knockout." And I'm looking at him right behind me, and there's two knockouts sitting there. I got two of them. I'm like, "Wow, you want a knockout? This game is like, you know," and it didn't look as good as that one in the picture. The back glass was totally wasted. And I'm like, "Man, it's really, you know, the knockouts are all complete, and, you know, I'll get it working for you and all that. You know, you don't got to worry about that, but it just seems kind of lopsided." And he's like, "Well, you know, that's what I want. You know, take it or leave it." And I'm like, "Yeah, I got to pass." You know, so he drives away, and I'm thinking about it. I'm going, "Oh, man, I'm never going to find a back glass for that game ever." So then he ends up trading it to this guy named Shay Assad. And Shay gives him, like, a knockout and four other wood rails. You know, and I'm like, "God, why am I so stupid?" And then, like, 2 weeks later, the Bat-a-score back glass is available as a reproduction. You know, and I'm like, "Oh, man, you know, can just stick the knife in and twist." And I've never found another one. I certainly never had one pull up into my driveway. Anyways, then, you know, Williams, after the war, Williams came about. I don't know. Did you guys ever hear the story of how Williams came about? Okay, so, you know, you had these two guys who were friends, Williams and I forget the guy's name that ran United. And they were, like, working together right after the war. And they made a bet over a girl. And, well, actually, no, the bet, I believe, was over horses. But the winner got the girl, and the loser had to leave the company. And so Harry Williams lost the bet, and he had to leave United, and he went and formed Williams. Anyways, that's kind of like a molested version of the story. But that's how Williams came about. Believe it or not. But anyway, so Williams then started coming out with baseball games, and these were pretty much the games that everybody remembers and that are pretty easy to find. The one on the left is got a horizontal running man unit. Almost all the Williams games had running man units that showed where your players were, and they were basically just big stepper units. But originally they were vertical. They did that for like a year, and then they went to horizontal ones, and then all their games more or less had horizontal running man units up to like 1973. So on the left you got Deluxe Baseball, on the right you got King of SWAT. And then so there were some other companies that came out with them too. And now, you know, here is United, and they've got on the lower right, you can see a running man unit. Boy, that looks awful lot like the Williams one, except he uses rubberized guys instead of cardboard guys. How did United get away with that? You know, because the running man unit in Williams was patented. Well, it's because Williams and the guy that ran United, whose name escapes me, you know, they were best buddies. even though they were running competing firms. But anyways, this is a great game, Star Slugger. Matter of fact, of the post-war baseballs, this is certainly one of the best ones. This one and the Evans batted score, I would say, are right up there. This is a great game. Huge, though. I mean, it's 7 feet tall, 7 feet long. It's a big monster game, but it's a great game. Three decks, and the bat hits it with three different hardnesses, because if you want to hit the lower deck, you don't want to hit the ball real hard. You just want to hit it hard enough to get it to the lower deck. So that's why. And then you get the super run home run hole. If you hit that, you get like 60 runs or something like that. It's bizarre. I mean, it's like a deviation of baseball rules, obviously. But it's actually a really fun game. And they're not too terrible to find, and they're not all that expensive either. You know, usually a couple grand you can get one of these. Another game, Genko again. This is kind of neat. You can see on the lower right-hand corner, the balls go up, and then they roll down that little green trough, and then they kind of fall off, and you got to time it and hit it with the bat and knock it through the air into one of those pockets that have, like, you know, the center ones are higher number of runs than the outside and the lower ones. This is a really neat game. Too, if you can find these. And they made another one called Champion Baseball, which is basically the same thing, but in a bigger footprint. Great game by Genko. Another Steve Kordak, Harvey Heist type thing. Here's a bizarre game by United. This kind of like combines three different games into one format. So you got a Shuffle Alley, you got Ski Ball and Baseball all in one game. And it's not doing any of those three things well either, you know. But so you got a puck. You throw the puck up. It hits a little ski jump on the end, jumps up and goes into one of these, like, ski ball holes. And the ski ball holes will give you either a double, a triple, or a homer, or a single. And, you know, you've got, I forget how many shots. I think you get, there's five innings, and you get three shots per inning. And it's just kind of a bizarre game, but, you know, it's kind of fun. You know, I liked it. It wouldn't fit in my damn basement, though. It's the top comes off, but it was too high and too long. I couldn't get it in my basement. So I ended up having to sell the game, which really broke my heart. Okay, then in 57, this is a game that's very iconic again, the Williams Deluxe Baseball. It's the one with the glass cutouts on the side. I don't really understand why it's so iconic, why people like it. It's a single-player game. It keeps track of, like, high scores and grand slams, but I don't really see the big whiff about it, but people love this game. The game that I like much better is the 59 Williams Pinch Hitter. To me, that's a much, much better game. For one, it's two-player. Has multiple pitches, so it's got a magnet under the playfield. As the ball comes by, you can throw a curveball. And it keeps track of strikes. So there's like a switch. If you whiff, it'll actually, you know, count a strike, which is one of the few pitching bats that actually do that. Pinch Hitter is a great game, but it's way more ugly than the classic 57. But it's not always about looks, you know. Well whatever. This is kind of an unusual game. This was by Chicago Coin. You can see it's got little mannequins on the playfield, and then see how nice and clean the playfield looks? That's because there's no ball. Okay, the ball doesn't roll on the playfield. It's light animation. So what you've got is you've got a little light that's on like a conveyor belt. It starts at the pitcher. The pitcher throws it, and then it's all about timing. You swing, and then the light will go, you know, across the playfield and go up, and you can get a home run. Or if you hit it to one of the players catch it, and then they throw you out. It's kind of a neat game. Unusual, pretty rare, hard to find. Here's a game, another iconic Williams game. A lot of people consider this one the most collectible of the post-war baseballs. I don't personally, but some people do. This one's called Official Baseball. It's got, again, mannequins on the playfield, but you've got a real ball that rolls, unlike the prior game. Also, the way the ball is pitched, instead of it coming out of a flap underneath the playfield, for some fucking bizarre reason, the umpire gives the ball to... I've never seen an umpire that stands behind a pitcher, unless I'm in Little League or something. T-ball, I guess that's where they stand. But, you know, how T-ball translates to Major League Baseball, I don't quite understand. But in this game, it does. But it's neat because it throws the ball like the 37 World Series, where the guy actually kind of throws the ball forward. It is a little more realistic, but there's no ramps. You can see, like, the prior games had ramps, you know, for the multiple decks, you know, to hit a home run. There's no ramps, and in order to get a home run. The home run is behind the center fielder, so you have to bank it off the side. It's a pretty tricky game to play. A lot of people don't like it because it is really difficult to play. So if you wanted a mindless game of baseball, this is not the game to play. But it's a cute-looking game. And it's a nice game. I don't want to say that it's not worth anything. It is. But I think it's maybe another one of those games that's overrated. Okay, so basically from 61 to 72, I'm pretty much don't like any of the baseballs that are out there. They're all pretty damn boring. You lose the wood rails. The wood rail era is over. You lose hole scoring. Notice on the official baseball, see how there's holes like in front of the guys in the playfield, you know, and holes in the back, and in front of the men there's holes. Starting around 61, 62, 63, the hole scoring goes away, and you get just got targets across the back. So you basically the playfield becomes largely useless. It's just this big, long, open playfield with nothing to hit. There's no holes or nothing to get in your way either. But now this game is cool because, see these little red turrets? Well, when they will be pointing towards you, if you have a man on first and you hit the ball to the shortstop, he'll throw it to the second baseman and throw him out, or throw it to the first baseman and throw him out. So these mechanical turrets actually move and then spit the ball back out for a double play. It's really a cool game, and it's, of course, got a running man unit in it, too, in the back glass. So you've got animation in the running man unit, and you got playfield animation, too, with this turret system. Really, really neat game. Okay, so like the last game in the EM era is the 1973 Williams Upper Deck. So they added electronic sound. So like if you hit a home run, fireworks go off in the back glass. It actually sounds like fireworks, believe it or not. And you hear the crowd going, yay, woo, woo, and you hear guys whistling, all done with these little electronic soundboards. It's pretty neat, and you got multiple decks to hit, you know, kind of like, you know, the old school games. Cute game, really ugly, this kind of olive drab 70s looking crap that your mother used to paint her kitchen. It kind of was that same color scheme that just pisses me off. But it's the last game of an era, because after this there was no more games with running man units. They still made baseballs, but no more with this like mechanical running man unit, which is really kind of depresses me. All right, so, you know, I haven't covered every type of EM game in the world. That's basically the history and style of all these different kind of EM games. There was a lot that I left out, of course, because, you know, Ron was beating me up. We're already, 20 minutes past his hour of doom. So, anyways, if you guys have any questions, just see me afterwards. I got to let Ron go so he doesn't get mad at me. But I'll be standing up here cleaning up. Just feel free to come on up and ask any questions. Thank you very much. I appreciate your time.